Welcome to the No More, Risk Better, a Credit Sites podcast. I'm Winnie Caesar, the Global Head of Strategy.
And I'm Zach Griffiths, the Credit Sites Senior Investment Grade Strategist.
As strategists, we aim to make sense of the macro and the micro, highlighting opportunities and the risks facing the fixed income markets.
As important as the macro call may be, we understand that credit investing, at its core, comes down to keen single name selection, and we at Credit Sites benefit from the expertise of our team of over 100 analysts across the US, Europe, and Asia.
This podcast offers a look at the conversations that we have with our analysts on a regular basis. If you are an investment professional focused on the wide universe of fixed income, you'll want to give this podcast a listen.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to No More, Risk Better, a Credit Sites podcast. I'm your host, Zach Griffiths, and joining me today is our head of autos research, Todd Duvick. Todd, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Good to be here, Zach.
So I understand you just downgraded your U.S. auto sector recommendation for both investment grade and high yield companies to an underperform rating from the outperform that you had initiated back in late November. And before I let you take us through the drivers of your change in recommendation, I want to just highlight how both IG and high yield autos have significantly outperformed their respective broader indexes since you went outperform. So great call there, Todd. Now that I have that out of the way, we certainly don't want to let any victory lap go unran. Why don't you take us through what you're seeing in the sector and the key drivers of why you decided to downgrade?
Okay, sure. So at the time we went outperform, you know, it was predicated on two factors, basically. The first was we've gone from a situation of extreme disruption related to COVID in terms of supply disruption. And so the first factor is we've largely worked through that and have gotten back to a much more stable place within the auto sector, where I think the production and profitability is going to be much more predictable going forward. But the other factor is, and it's related to that first factor, is we had expected at that time Ford, which has been below investment grade for basically since the onset of the pandemic, we'd expected them to be upgraded back to investment grade by two of the agencies. And since that time, they have been upgraded. They were the largest constituent in the high yield autos index. And so them migrating out of the high yield index into the investment grade index, they now have performed well, and they're the largest or one of the largest constituents of the investment grade autos index, what we think is probably the best value. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But as a result of their migration, also the high yield auto index kind of reset levels much wider, which we thought would be attractive as well for the high yield investors. And so those were really the two factors. And so now the high yield autos index is comprised exclusively of auto suppliers, the largest of which is Goodyear Tire. And then the investment grade index is a high quality index overall for autos that has a shorter duration. So, you know, that's the other reason that we have downgraded the IG autos index, is the duration there is under four compared to the overall IG index north of six. And so it's a shorter duration indices. So our underperform recommendation is relative value, that it's now trading inside the overall IG index, but it's also much shorter duration. And so I think you can speak better to this than I can, but I think it's kind of the house view that we're still comfortable or constructive on duration. And so the fact that, you know, the auto sector is short on duration, we just think that even though we're comfortable, if you're looking to outperform, the auto sector just doesn't have enough duration to really outperform here in 2024 going forward.
Thanks, Todd. That's definitely our view in terms of thinking about credit versus duration risk. Spreads are very tight. And so we have been indicating to clients that we're a little bit more comfortable taking duration risk at this point. And the 10-year treasury yield, for example, has traded in a fairly tight range. We've drifted off of the highs of around 430. We're back toward 410. But that certainly resonates with us in the shorter duration quality of the IG autos would not necessarily be beneficial in terms of our overarching call. And so kind of taking all of that together, obviously, it's been a good call that's worked well, and maybe just time to take some chips off the table after a strong run. And, you know, factoring in what we're seeing with Ford and the index migration, with all of that behind us, everything kind of reset to a more steady state, at least for now. What did the operating environment look like for autos in Q4? And how does that fit into the overall picture when you look ahead for your sector?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you take a look at the kind of the background for the fourth quarter, retail demand for autos continues to be strong, really. The U.S. consumer is in a good place in general, even though you have both elevated borrowing costs and elevated transaction prices. You've also seen pretty significant wage growth and ability of many borrowers to purchase autos with the higher payments. And it all comes down to the payment. Most of the autos that are purchased are financed. You've got a higher payment that's about 25% higher than it was pre-pandemic. So we think that's supported by lower unemployment and the fact that, you know, the vast majority of borrowers are going to be have credit scores of prime plus. So the demand background was very strong in the fourth quarter. From a production standpoint, I'll really take a look at it, bifurcate the U.S. versus the Asian OEMs, which I also cover. So the likes of Toyota, Honda, Hyundai all did very well in the fourth quarter because their supply chain improved, semiconductor availability improved, their production has improved, and their efficiency of the plant has improved, and they're able to cover their fixed costs with higher volume. So their profitability was very strong, improving year on year. The U.S. automakers were more of a mixed bag, and that's primarily related to the United Auto Workers strike that caused several plant shutdowns. Demand for their vehicles was strong, so the top line was still overall healthy, but because they weren't able to produce as many vehicles as they had wanted, and then they had they still had to pay for the labor, their profitability was lower year over year, but, you know, that's a one-time event that is past them now. It's not going to recur until another 4 years until the current contract runs out. And so, you know, it was a bit of a mixed bag, but big picture, we think that the auto industry is set up for a solid 2024. And even though it was weaker for the U.S. automakers from a profitability standpoint in the fourth quarter, we don't think that's an indicator for what profitability is going to be in 2024. We think that, you know, both Ford and GM provided guidance, which was basically largely flat year on year, which in an industry that is known to be very cyclical, we think flat year coming off of very strong profitability is actually a positive indicator, especially from bondholders. Maybe not for the equity market, but good for bondholders.
I got a couple quick follow-ups for you on that, Todd. So you made a comment that the vast majority of borrowers have scores of prime plus these days. Has that been fairly constant over time, or is that an improvement post-COVID following all of the ructions and all of the stimulus that we saw both on a fiscal and monetary basis?
So it has improved through COVID, but it's really a trend that has been in force since really the Great Recession. So if you take a look at the credit scores, the average credit scores of borrowers pre-Great Financial Crisis, it was materially lower than it is today. I mean, you're not talking about the vast majority of borrowers even then were subprime, but there was a higher portion of subprime borrowers pre-Great Financial Crisis. And that category has definitely continued to decline to the point where today it's less than, well, for the automakers that we're talking about, Ford, GM, Toyota, Honda, less than 10% of the borrowers have subprime credit scores. And it's closer to 5%, really. So the average credit score has definitely increased. And what that does is, since the vast majority of auto sector debt is actually from the captive finance subsidiaries, having a higher credit score among the borrowers helps with the delinquencies and with the charge-offs. So, you know, we think that when we go into a recession, which is going to happen eventually, so when that happens, we think with the with the borrowers having higher credit scores, you know, the amplitude of the charge-offs and the delinquencies is going to be lower than probably in previous cycles.
That's helpful context. I wasn't really aware, although I'm not necessarily shocked to hear that we have fewer subprime borrowers in pretty much any market compared to pre-GFC, but I want to drill down a little bit more. Are there any other key takeaways from the captive finance side of the operations from Q4 results to overlay with kind of what you mentioned with profitability taking a little bit of a hit in the fourth quarter following the UAW and reset of those contracts? But overall, it sounds like the message from an operations and profitability perspective is it's not going to get hit as much as you may have feared with the big increase in labor costs. So I guess let's go back to that captive finance side and any indications on the state of the U.S. consumer from that.
You know, it's interesting because during COVID, delinquencies and charge-offs were expected right at the beginning of COVID. No one knew what was going to happen, but it was expected that the delinquencies and charge-offs would just really spike. That didn't happen, partly because of the COVID relief package that was passed, I think three installments, two under Trump, one under Biden. So what we saw instead was the charge-offs and delinquencies actually declined to much lower levels than normal. And so now what we've seen is we've seen largely the delinquencies and charge-offs normalize to historic levels, but still, you know, in very strong position. The profitability, which was just extremely profitable in 2021 and 2022, has also normalized, which means that profitability at the captive finance subsidiaries has declined. But, you know, you're back to more normal levels. So we think that having bond investors invest in captive finance paper is a good risk given the employment outlook. Now, you know, we expect unemployment to increase, just like we saw last week. The most recent unemployment report, I think it has increased to 3.9%, and it could drift higher modestly this year, I think is kind of the consensus forecast. But still, putting that in historical context, unemployment is still fairly low, and we think that that's probably the number one driver for delinquencies is the unemployment rate. So, you know, we think we're fairly comfortable, even though we think it's going to drift somewhat higher. You know, the profitability and the charge-offs is still really fairly strong compared to what it was pre-recession, or I should say pre-COVID.
Great. So normalization, I feel like, is a key term that we heard even back when we were considering our outlook for this year from a strategy perspective, wondering if it was time to get a little bit more bearish. And when we came to you guys on the analyst team, especially when it comes to the U.S. consumer, I think there's a normalization of trends, just as you outlined, both for the captive finance and these, you know, these charge-offs and delinquency levels. That's certainly consistent with what we're hearing across other sectors, even some of the more discretionary items. And so we are expecting the unemployment rate to move a little bit higher this year. You're right, 3.9% is the latest as of February. We could see it moving into the low fours. So that's a bit of a move, but nothing too crazy, not a level that would be consistent with a recession in the past. And that's not our base case for 2024. So shifting gears a little bit, thinking about the primary market activity we've seen to start 2024, it's been pretty incredible across investment grade and high yield, breaking records depending on how you look at it. Have the auto manufacturers and OEMs, the names that you cover, been big issuers to start the year? And what's your outlook for supply look like going forward? I know we just put together a report looking at visible supply coming from all of our sectors. Take us through what you're seeing.
Sure. You know, the auto sector is a frequent issuer, primarily through the captive, similar to the banking industry. And they have been frequent issuers. America Honda Finance, which is Honda's U.S. captive finance arm. They were in the market today. We had Ford in the market for Ford Credit last week. And so this is really, it's nothing unusual. They have participated, but it's more normal course of the business for them. These captive finance subsidiaries are typically in the market 3 to 4 times per year. They usually start, you know, in early January. I think America Honda Finance, the last time they were in the market was actually January 2nd, the first trading day of the year. So this is their second time already. And they tend to try and front load their issuance needs. And, you know, the issuance for these subsidiaries is typically to, number one, refinance upcoming maturities, but also it depends on what finance receivables are doing. Finance receivables have been growing for these companies as sales have increased. And sales have increased as, you know, they've been able to get past the supply chain issues, produce more, provide more vehicles to dealers and then meet the consumer demand. So, you know, I think that in addition to financing the upcoming debt maturities, they're also financing a higher level of finance receivables as sales increase. So we expect to continue to see them in the market. You know, basically the major captives, speaking of Toyota, Ford, GM, and Honda, and Hyundai, another couple times this year, but they definitely have hit it hard so far this year, and we expect to continue to see them. On the auto supplier side, we don't expect really a lot of issuance from them. There's really not a big issuance wall for them to refinance until 2025. With the exception of Magna, which is the highest rated supplier in our coverage universe. They're low A rated, and they were actually in the market last week with a 5-year. And that's really, you know, all we expect to see from the auto supplier industry.
In terms of issuance, it's, you know, it's been a busy start to the year. You said you're seeing that in your names as well. Any interesting stats coming out of the primary market activity? I know that we look at it from a strategy perspective and primary market demand, whether you look at new issue concessions or order books, was very strong to start the year, remains strong, but probably already seeing some signs of normalization even over the past couple of weeks. Were there any interesting deals or interesting indications from how any of these deals went in terms of the primary market from your perspective, Todd?
I wouldn't say there were any big ahas here. I think because they are frequent issuers, it's pretty much been the investor base knows which names are comfortable in, and it's going to depend on the day that they issue, you know, how much the new issue concession is going to be. What we have seen lately is, you know, some of the automakers issue on very heavy supply days where I think it's very unusual, at least in my experience, to see, you know, 20 deals come to the market in one day. And I think that has been kind of consistent with maybe wider new issue concessions than what I would normally expect for these names, because, you know, we've seen many times new issue concessions are basically nil. But we have seen more attractive new issue concessions for some of the names lately, which I think, you know, is good for investors, especially, as you say, in a market where spreads seem to be so compressed.
Yeah, things are very tight right now. I'd say in virtually all of our client meetings, the question is how tight can spreads go? The focus hasn't been on what is the key catalyst to take us wider. So that's certainly interesting perspective. And I also want to get your thoughts. I mean, it's CPI week here in the US. We're recording on March 11th. We get US CPI for February out tomorrow. Used cars and trucks has been a widely focused on subcomponent of CPI as it, you know, was massively skyrocketing due to those supply chain concerns that you mentioned after and during COVID, I suppose. Whereas last month, we had the largest month-on-month decline at about 3.4%. That's the largest since March 2022, when prices fell 3.3%. I know we kind of went through some of the fundamentals in the sector. Sounds like you're still seeing strong demand. But how do you think what you're seeing translates into the future of used car prices, kind of getting through this normalization of supply difficulties, but demand also seemingly remaining quite strong?
I think the key, and I'm going to use that term again, normalization, is the factor that's really impacting pricing as well. And it's not so much from the actual price of the vehicles on dealer lots, but it's from the incentives being offered. So, you know, what we saw as a function of supply and demand with supply being tight during COVID was the incentives being offered, which, you know, pre-COVID had been over $4,000 per vehicle. It had gone down to less than $1,000 per vehicle during COVID. And so, again, we're seeing normalization of the incentives. So it's not actually the sticker price, but it's the incentives being offered in terms of discounts, whether it's a below market interest rate or an actual dollars off the vehicle being offered. That's rebounded from, you know, like I said, less than $1,000 per vehicle in late 2021 to about $2,500 per vehicle today. So that's where we're seeing the decline in pricing is the net price, so the average transaction prices after those incentives. And so we think that's going to continue. I think Cox Automotive, they expect, you know, these incentives to be around the $2,500 to $3,000 range per vehicle. So not getting back to where they were pre-COVID, but still kind of in a range. And so I think if you take a look at that, that's going to continue to be a pressure on pricing on a year-over-year basis. But we think sequentially, it's not going to be near as weak.
That's interesting. Yeah, I feel like I heard during COVID that 2021 timeframe of buyers paying even over MSRP in certain instances, which is kind of wild to consider when you think about the average reduction from MSRP of 4,000 pre-COVID. So normalization, you know, again, the key term when thinking about some of these trends. But I suppose we can't talk about the auto sector without getting into the electric vehicle adoption and what's going on with that aspect of the industry. I saw recently Rivian really taking a hit and a lot of change, or not necessarily change, but kind of a realization of demand for EVs and things like that. So take us through what you're seeing and how it is impacting your names and your view of the sector.
Yeah, so I mean, EVs are the big shiny object in the auto industry. Everyone likes to talk about them. There are a lot of stories on them. But if you take a look at the profitability, there are only a few companies, two big companies that are making manufacturing EVs. And those are Tesla and then China's BYD, which is backed by, you know, Berkshire Hathaway. Those are the two largest EV manufacturers in the world. All the other EVs manufactured by the likes of Ford, GM, and the traditional automakers, for the most part, are losing money. Hyundai is the only one that claims that they are making money manufacturing and selling EVs, although they haven't broken out the exact data to prove that, but they claim that. So, you know, I think if you take a look at EVs, especially in the US, Tesla has had a real cachet to it in terms of ownership. It's been, you know, prestigious to own a Tesla. They have been priced at a premium. And I think for the most part, the owners have been individuals who have been higher income and have also had the ability in many cases to install a charger in their garage, which, you know, several years ago itself cost several thousand dollars just to install a charger in your garage. So, you know, it wasn't a cheap proposition. I think many of these early adopters have already gotten their vehicles. And so we're on to the next phase of the more, I would say, the more mainstream purchaser of vehicles. And there you've got a couple issues that are preventing the same rate of growth from continuing. And that is range anxiety. You can't charge everywhere. So the charging infrastructure is underdeveloped compared to having a gasoline powered vehicle that have so many gas stations. Plus, when you go to these chargers, public chargers, instead of gas station where you can be in and out in, what, 10 minutes? There, you have to charge 20 minutes, best case scenario, to charge your battery to about 80% of its range. Some chargers, you know, may take upwards of an hour. So, you know, you've got the inconvenience factor of charging. And then if you're in an apartment, you may not have access to the chargers for charging at home, or a limited number that may be full. So you've got these issues that I think are preventing wider spread adoption of EVs. And then finally, the price of many EVs has been more expensive than gas-powered vehicles. So I think these are the factors that really need additional work for wider spread adoption of EVs to take place.
Do you own an EV, Todd?
I do not. And according to my wife, I'll have to wait for a second wife before I do. She's not receptive to that. But, you know, I think that I do think there will be, you know, wider spread EV adoption, but it's going to be those factors that I mentioned. It's just my wife is probably not on the cutting edge of receptivity.
Yeah, we've got some family members that have electric vehicles, and even driving to Charlotte from where they're coming from, they have to stop and charge, and it's kind of a 45-minute stop, you know, compared to stopping at a gas station to fill up your tank, like you said, 10 minutes in and out. So that's definitely something that has occurred to me when considering if we need a new vehicle, would it be an electric vehicle or not? So definitely interesting to kind of take all of that into account and see how we're sort of moving on to that next phase, at least in terms of Tesla buyers, and kind of now that that first maybe lower hanging fruit has kind of gone away, how do they adapt from here? And so one last topic I'd want to finish on is just thinking about China risk in the sector. Their economy really hasn't come out of COVID the way some had anticipated. I know our China macro analyst, Zerlina Zhang, is a little bit more optimistic on the China growth outlook relative to the consensus. How is that factoring into the names you cover and thinking about demand for autos, I suppose, from a global perspective?
Yeah, that's a great question. So if you take a look at China, the Chinese market has really fundamentally shifted since prior to COVID. So China is the largest passenger vehicle market in the world. And in order to do business there, back in the early 2000s, the Chinese government said that, the foreign automakers could go there, but they had to establish joint ventures with local companies. So they did that. And China has been a real profit pool for many automakers. GM, pre-COVID, they were routinely making $2 billion per year on their operations in China. However, in that 20-year timeframe, the Chinese government invested heavily in backing automakers to produce electric vehicles. And so throughout COVID, those EV makers like BYD, NIO, and others really came into their own, such that in China, about a quarter of the sales of vehicles are EVs, and that compares to about 8% in the U.S. It's a higher portion in Europe, but that's largely regulatory driven. But these EV automakers are selling as many vehicles as they can in China, and they're looking for other markets. And so they have started exporting to Europe, countries like Norway, which is in percentage terms, the largest EV market in the world. They have a target of getting to almost full EV participation by, I think, 2025 or 2026. So a very high adoption rate, again, regulatory driven there. So the point is, the Chinese EV makers are looking for other markets. Their BYD is looking at building a plant in central Mexico. They claim not for export to the U.S., but in my view, that's just a matter of time before they come here. Currently, there is a 27.5% import tariff on any Chinese vehicles that would be imported into the U.S. But given their cost advantage, they could still import vehicles into the U.S. and sell them very competitively with existing EVs. So I think it's just a matter of time. So you've got a situation where what's the impact on U.S. automakers as well as Japanese and European automakers? It's that they need to lower the cost of their manufacturing for EVs to be competitive with China. Stellantis, which is the former Chrysler, which is a name that is covered by my counterpart, Jim Williamson, in London, their CEO said, I think 2 weeks ago in an interview, that import tariffs, in his opinion, aren't a fix. It can be a Band-Aid solution for the short run, but in the long run, he feels that they need to be competitive from a cost standpoint anywhere in the world that they manufacture. So that's a real challenge, for especially U.S. automakers that just went through a round of labor negotiations in which they agreed to 25% wage increases for their workers over a 4-year time frame. That's going to be a tremendous headwind. How do you compete with the likes of a BYD in that environment? So, it's a real issue that I don't think it's going to affect the industry today necessarily, but it's going to be here soon. And, the U.S., really all the global automakers need to prepare for that, become more efficient so that they can compete. Because just like we saw a Japanese wave of OEMs come to the U.S. in the 70s and the Koreans come in the 90s, the Chinese are coming. It's just a matter of time.
Well, I think that's a great point to leave our listeners on as a risk to consider and monitor going forward, at least for investors in the U.S. automakers. So thank you, Todd, for coming on the podcast. This was a great discussion. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Thanks, Zach. Appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening in. We'll catch you next time on No More Risk Better.
Credit Sites disclaimer. All price references correspond to the date of this recording.
This podcast should not be copied, distributed, or reproduced in whole or in part. Neither credit sites nor its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of any information contained in this podcast. Credit sites is not providing investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, is not providing research or making any recommendations, nor is credit sites offering or soliciting any transaction with respect to the purchase or sale of any security. The receipt by this listener of this podcast is not the giving of advice by credit sites or its affiliates.